I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Poets are often called on to speak at inaugurations, graduations, weddings, funerals, openings and closings, and anniversaries to mark the importance of a moment in time. We asked Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Jericho Brown to be our guest on Radio Times today as we mark the one-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd under the knee of former police officer Derek Chauvin. Brown won the 2020 Pulitzer for his latest collection, The Tradition, which the committee called, quote, a collection of masterful lyrics that combine delicacy with historical urgency in their loving evocation of bodies vulnerable to hostility and violence. Jericho Brown grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana, and is director of the Creative Writing Program at Emory University. He's also this year's One Book, One Philadelphia Writer, a project of the Free Library and the city to encourage literacy and discussion across the region. He joins us on Radio Times to read some poems, to talk about the importance of poetry, and to share some of his thoughts on today. Jericho Brown, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. Good morning. Good morning to you, Marty.
Good morning to you as well. And I know I'm asking a lot of poetry and frankly a lot of you to help us give some meaning for today. Nonetheless, I think you're up to the task. And I'm just curious about what your thoughts are, what you're thinking, what you're feeling today.
To be honest with you, I'm thinking about your voice. I'm really,
really?
Amazed that you, everything you
thing.
Said, you said without a stutter. I see why you have the job that you have. It was really, I really wish that I could speak as well as you are speaking.
Well, you know, let me just stop you there. That's like 40,000 reads to get it right on the radio, nonetheless. But go ahead, Jericho. I appreciate that.
I'm glad that... that people can call on the poets is what I've been thinking about in this moment. Poetry is that thing you needed that you didn't know you needed. And moments like this, anniversaries like this, pandemics like the one that we are surviving, those kinds of moments, people find that they need poetry more than anything, that it does something for the soul, that it becomes a balm for a part of ourselves that is not necessarily physical. And so I'm happy.
Oh, dear. I think we might have lost our guest. Let's see if we can get him back. And again, our guest is poet Jericho Brown. And in the meantime, we want to hear from you always on Radio Times. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always pick up the phone. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And to be honest with you, we were trying to figure out what should we talk about today as we mark this tragic anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. I think we all have seen that 9.5-minute video of Derek Chauvin's knee on his neck. And we were casting about trying to figure out what kind of show we would do. And we're trying to reconnect with him as I'm watching the studio here. We decided that we needed a poet, and that's why we have Jericho Brown. And we have you back, Jericho Brown. This is live radio, so thanks for joining us. Okay, we're back. We're back on the air. Jericho, can you hear me? Okay, that's okay.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's live radio. Now. Don't worry about it. So you were talking about just how poetry can frankly help us all, I think, in these difficult moments.
Yeah, well, poetry makes clear to us emotions that we did not understand. It articulates our emotions for us, and it tells us the truth. And it puts us in conversations that we're not going to have even with the people closest to us that are hard for us, conversations that are hard for us to have at the dinner table, conversations we're certainly not having while having a regular chat right in the grocery store line with the person in front of or behind us. Poetry takes things humorously and seriously, and it always tells the truth.
Let me quote something that you said in an interview. You said, writing has changed my life. Poems have kept me alive and kept me going. Poetry gives me energy. Poetry changes my mind. Poetry wakes me up. And when people talk about poetry making change, it's like they're expecting poetry to make some sort of governmental change. But poetry happens in your heart to you, the individual. And I wanted to underscore that because, you know, we are looking for government to do something to help us in this moment that we're in. But nonetheless, poetry doesn't necessarily do that.
Yes, but as with all things, we find that anything we want, we have to make up our minds about. Within ourselves, we have to change that thing about ourselves before we can change it about the world around us. And that's what poetry has been for me. I don't know how it works for everybody else, but I know that when I read a poem, I have to change the way I live because it puts me in a position where I have to change the way I think. And I want to have some integrity. I want to be honest with myself about what I'm doing. And I keep getting brought to that over and over again through the poems I read.
So many of your poems are about black bodies, frankly, and you know, that takes us back to that 9.5 minute video that, you know, we watched, we didn't want to watch, but I think we were required to really watch those 9.5 minutes, the end of George Floyd's life.
I can't believe I tried to avoid it, but it became impossible to avoid it. I don't know if I've seen all 9 of those minutes straight through from beginning to end, but I imagine that I've seen tidbits of them until you end up seeing the whole thing. It's almost like watching a series on television because we've been watching it for a year.
Can I have you read a poem that you wrote? It's in your new collection, your Pulitzer Prize-winning collection. It's called Bullet Points.
Yeah, sure, I'll read that. It's a poem that I wrote after finding out about and being really confused by the deaths of people like Jesus Huerta in North Carolina, Victor White III in Texas, and Sandra Bland. Victor White III in Louisiana and Sandra Bland in Texas. It's a poem about people who have supposedly committed suicide while in police custody under very odd circumstances. Bullet points. I will not shoot myself in the head, and I will not shoot myself in the back, and I will not hang myself with a trash bag. And if I do, I promise you, I will not do it in a police car while handcuffed or in the jail cell of a town I only know the name of because I have to drive through it to get home. Yes, I may be at risk, but I promise you, I trust the maggots who live beneath the floorboards of my house to do what they must to any carcass more than I trust an officer of the law of the land to shut my eyes like a man of God might, or to cover me with a sheet so clean my mother could have used it to tuck me in. When I kill me, I will do it the same way most Americans do. I promise you, cigarette smoke, or a piece of meat on which I choke, or so broke I freeze in one of these winters we keep calling worst. I promise if you hear of me dead anywhere near a cop, then that cop killed me. He took me from us and left my body, which is, no matter what we've been taught, greater than the settlement a city can pay a mother to stop crying, and more beautiful than the new bullet fished from the folds of my brain.
That is our guest, Jericho Brown, again reading from his Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of poems called The Tradition, and that's a poem called Bullet Points. And I have to say, hearing you, I've read that multiple times, and then hearing you read that just takes my breath away. This sort of mix of homicide and suicide.
I think what I always think about when I read this poem is the figure of the mother.
Yeah.
And this is part of what I've been talking about. You know, when we see that 9.5 minute video, we're watching somebody's son, we're watching a family member, we're watching somebody's brother, we're watching somebody who, for all we know, was really good at making turkey sandwiches. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes I think we get lost in the political in a way that we forget that we're talking about real human beings, real people, people who have been and want to be held. So that's the kind of thing that really comes out to me when I read that poem.
And your line there, to cover me with a sheet so clean my mother could have used it to tuck me in.
Yeah, I came up with that line thinking about Mike Brown's murder and how after that murder, his body lay in the street for so long. You remember that,
I
Marty. His
do.
body lay in the street for so long, and there was someone who took the risk of going through the police barricade and covering Just somebody from the community, somebody from the neighborhood took the risk. I mean, risked his life to cover up, to show the respect of covering up that dead boy's body. And I think that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking about in that moment. It was very scary to me to think about that, to think that my body could be lying in the street like that, and that my mother, my family would not even have the opportunity to show respect for the dead body.
I think I know the answer to this. Have you had altercations with the police?
Yes, I have had altercations with the police. It's really an interesting thing, too. There's so much response. I'm grateful for the response. There are so many people who are awakened now to the fact of black and brown people's relationship to the police, and how that relationship is very different from other people in the world, in the United States in particular. And it's fascinating to me that in spite of my own experiences with the police, you know, I've been thrown over the hood of my own car for no reason. I've had police follow me into my driveway and ask me if everything was okay.
And the answer to that is?
Well, everything was okay until you followed me into my driveway and walked, I mean, made me afraid to get out of my car in my own driveway. And then, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Shreveport, police would hassle us. We were just little kids, you know what I mean? So, I'm fascinated that that this moment is the moment that more people are listening to something that many of us knew was going on our entire lives for generations.
If we're listening, I mean, I almost hate to ask this, and we're about a minute away from our first break here, but I mean, do you see we're at a moment, kind of at a crossroads? Perhaps I can put it that way.
I hope so. It would be really nice if we were at a crossroads. We'll have to see. I often think we're at a crossroads and then we revert. You know what I mean? Sometimes there's a regression instead of progression. But I do think this, and I think it's very important for me to say this, there are a lot of people who say that things are no better than they ever were, but I know better than that. I know I'm not a slave. I know that I'm not a sharecropper. I know that there are people I read whose poems I love who never intended me know how to read their poems. You know what I mean? So I think things are better, and as long as things keep getting better, even though they seem horrendously slow, then mm-hmm. we're in a good position. It's our job to help make things happen better, faster. And that's why so many people have taken to the street. That's why we have this day of memorial that we're having today.
That is Jericho Brown, our guest on Radio Times today. He's a poet. He's director of the creative writing program at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And his latest collection, The Tradition, won the Pulitzer Prize. He's won other awards and honors for his poems as well. We're going to take a very short break, have another poem or two or three or four from our guests, and we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with poet Jericho Brown, and we have been talking about race and police brutality as we mark the first anniversary of the death of George Floyd. His poems also are about nature and a virus and family and really a fascinating juxtaposition of both tenderness and violence. And I want to have you read another poem for us, this one called The Tradition, which, of course, is a title of your new book. But just a quick comment from one of our listeners, Elizabeth, she's a poet herself, has been able to release a lot of anxiety and fear over the last year into her poems. It has kept her sane, made her feel connected to people, even if it is just on Zoom. And from one poet to another, Jericho, anything you want to say back to Elizabeth?
I just want to say keep up with the work. Elizabeth, thank you for calling in. Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Let me have you read The Tradition.
The Tradition. Aster, nasturtium, delphinium. We thought fingers in dirt meant it was our dirt. Learning names in heat, in elements classical philosophers said could change us. Stargazer, foxglove. Summer seemed to bloom against the will of the sun, which news reports claimed flamed hotter on this planet than when our dead fathers wiped sweat from their necks. Cosmos, baby's breath. Men like me and my brothers filmed what we planted for proof we existed before too late. Sped the video to see blossoms brought in seconds, colors you expect in poems where the world ends, everything cut down. John Crawford, Eric Garner, Mike Brown.
And again, that's our guest, Jericho Brown, reading from his new collection of poems, The Tradition, actually won the Pulitzer Prize last year. I mean, you begin, this is about sort of life and death, right? You begin with asters and nasturtiums and delphiniums and end with John Crawford, Eric Garner, and Mike Brown.
Yeah, it's a poem about the land, right? It's a poem about the earth. It's a poem about the environment and the natural world. And the work we're doing to keep it alive. It's a poem about the beauty of nature. And so more than that, though, it's a poem about how you can't write a poem about one thing. You know, I really, when I started this book, I really just wanted to write about my flower garden in the front yard, my flower bed in the front yard that I had been working on for so long. And it became clear to me with everything that was going on that my poems weren't just going to be about flowers and trees. They had to reach beyond those flowers and trees. And I really do believe it's possible for us to have more than one concern at a time. As a matter of fact, I think that's part of what makes us human beings. We're more complex and we like to sort of narrow one another down and think of issues as, I don't know, women's issues or black issues or queer issues, when in actuality, they're all human issues. And until these problems are solved, we're all in a little bit of trouble. A great deal of trouble, actually.
A great deal of trouble. I'm curious about how you write, whether you sit down to write poetry or whether you keep a little notebook somewhere or, you know, how you do what you do, Jericho Brown.
It's all of the above. I was thinking about this when you mentioned Elizabeth's comment earlier. Poets are out here fighting, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
I sit down to write a poem. However I can get a poem, I have poems that I start in the notes app of my iPhone. I take lines from poems that have failed in the past, and I try to slip them into poems that seem to be working and see if those lines will help that new poem somehow. So I do it all kinds of ways, any way I can get it done. I have been, you know, I'm the kind of a writer. I'm the kind of poet. I will pull my car over in traffic just to get something down.
Wow.
I don't want to miss it. I don't want to miss it when the spirit comes. I want to enjoy the spirit, you know.
That's interesting to me. I don't want to miss it. So it's like, it's what, words are coming at you?
Yeah, you know, Phil Levine used to tell this story about how he said he was getting older, but when he feels a line, he has to get somewhere and write the line down. And he used to say, and he was living in Fresno, California at the time, and he said, when the spirit of poetry, when the muse flies over you and drops language into your soul, you have to catch the language. You've got to write it down. If you don't, he said, if I don't write the language down, it will fly over my house and go to Northern California and drop into Adrienne Rich's mind, and she'll have the poem I wanted to write. So, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know when you're going to get the next poem, but you always want to see it. So you're just working on it all the time.
Well, I love that idea of poets fighting over words that are flying over their houses.
Yeah.
Right? It's a great image.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to the work you do in a way. You're always looking for the next story. You're trying to tell the next tale. You're trying to get the word out about things that people need to know.
You grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana, a place I've never been. I don't even know. I don't even have an image, a picture of it. What was that like for you? What kind of place is that?
Well, the food is great, and there's a church on every corner. now there's a church on every corner and a casino on every other corner.
Oh, gosh.
It wasn't that way when I was growing up. When I was growing up, the only casino was in my grandmother's house. She ran an illegal card game that she was very famous for, and people would come from all over North Louisiana to go to it. So that's a little bit of what my childhood was like. Yeah, I loved Shreveport when I was growing up.
So now you've got two religions competing with each other, churches and casinos, right?
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. You can go to one and then go to the other right after. So any way you look at it.
And what was the card game that your grandma played or had at her house?
Well, that's a great question. They were playing Pitty Pat and Tonk. And when they would play Tonk, you know, she sort of had a charge fee at the door, and then she took a little charges at the table. She took a cut of the table. And I learned to play Pitty Pat and Tonk. But usually when my family is together, we play spades. And my friends who are poets are always making fun of me because I'm always, whenever poets get together, I'm always trying to get a spades game started. But I love playing spades. It's a lot of fun. I can't play in Atlanta. I used to play in Louisiana all the time. In Atlanta, it's a little cutthroat down here. You got to be careful playing spades.
Oh, okay. Next time I'm there, I'll be on guard about that. Help us understand about the influence of the church, the Black church, and on you as a young person. I think you sang in the choir, but also just the connection between the church service and the poem.
I think it was everything. I think church really became the metaphor for writing for me at the base of it. You know, there was an order of service. Every Sunday, the same thing was going to happen. It's like form in a poem. It's like a sonnet. You know it's going to be 14 lines. You know it's going to rhyme. You know it's going to have iambic pentameter. Every Sunday, it was the same order of service, and yet there was a different thing to see every Sunday. You know, there might be a little kid who would stand up and recite a poem like Still I Rise by Maya Angelou or The Negro Speaks of Rivers by Langston Hughes. I had the greatest pastor anyone could ever have, the Reverend Harry Blake, who was a wonderful, wonderful orator and would have everyone screaming and crying and running all over the church just from his words. You know, of course I became a poet. I was so inspired by the fact that I was seeing this man, this civil rights leader. This brings me a little bit of a grief as I speak this, because Reverend Blake, Pastor Blake died of COVID last year. So that was a very difficult time for me because he was such a huge mentor to me. And when I think about the power of the word, I think about him. I think about him standing up in that pulpit and saying things or reading things from the Bible or interpreting things for us and people emotionally and outwardly reacting to that. And that's what I want from my poems. You know, I'm from a tradition where when you hear a good poem, you throw things, you throw a shoe. So the poet has to be careful. They might get beat up, you know. And I'm from that church tradition. When someone was really singing, you know, they'd get hit in the back. They'd be singing so well. So that's part of what I got from church. I figured out that words have power.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And since you mentioned your grandmother, I'd love to have you read Good White People. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, though. That's Jericho Brown, our guest on Radio Times today. And he is the writer for the One Philadelphia, One Book annual event here in the city of Philadelphia. And he got the Pulitzer Prize last year for his latest collection of poems, and it's called The Tradition. And you can always join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. So Good White People.
Here we go. Good white people. Not my phrase, I swear, but my grandmother's, when someone surprised her by holding open the door or by singing that same high C Stephanie Mills holds near the end of I Have Learned to Respect the Power of Love, or by gifting her with a turkey on the 24th of December after a year of not tipping her for cleaning what they could afford not to clean. You'll have to forgive my grandmother with her good hair and her good white people and her certified good slap across your mouth. Crack the beaten door to eat or sing, but do not speak evil. Dead, bad, black woman I still love. She didn't know what we know. In America today, anyone can turn on a TV or look out a window or see several kinds of bird in the air while each face watching smiles and spits, cusses and sings a single anthem of blood. All is stained. She was ugly. I'm ugly. You're ugly too. No such thing as good white people.
Mm, And there's a lot in that poem to talk about. One is this word good, which doesn't mean good, correct?
Yeah, it doesn't mean good. it doesn't mean good at all. You know, we're a country of underdogs. You know, even the wealthiest people in this country see themselves as underdogs. And I really think it's a poem just about figuring out your own privilege, figuring out where you have a leg up, figuring out where how the so-called kind things you do might not be enough in a system where, you know, we're caught up in a kind of a capitalist and racist system, a misogynist system. And so we have to remember that some of us benefit from that system. In some ways, even I have benefited from that system. And so I think that's part of what this poem is about. So there's a way that it begins taking the grandmother to task, right? Yeah. But it also, because I'm taking my grandmother to task, that should let you know I'm going to be taking everybody else to task too, including myself.
Well, including all of us. And we need that, frankly, just to underscore what you said there. Let me just read a comment from Sharon. She says, listening to Jericho's poem on suicide and homicide moved me in a way that I haven't been moved before about George Floyd's death. I just sat here and cried. That's a comment from Sharon.
Well, thank you, Sharon. Thanks all for right. listening.
I mean, you talk about, you know, poets wanting people to be dancing and throwing shoes at them or reacting to their words.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I think a poet wants, though, is a real reaction. You know, the first reaction is indeed the emotional reaction, that feeling of crying that Sharon is having, that feeling of wanting to throw the shoe. You sort of feel yourself get excited when you hear a really good poem. But then after that, you don't just want the emotional reaction. I think the best poems in the world don't just make for good emotion. They make for good action. You know, first you have the emotional reaction, but then you have the intellectual reaction. Because you're crying, you think to yourself, why am I crying? Right? And that thought, if you think on it long enough, should lead to a change in action. Or it should lead to you finally taking action. So that's what I really hope from my poems, and that's what I want from the poems I read. I want poems that make me get up and move, that change my life, that make me live differently and treat people better.
In that poem you just read, you write about your grandmother's certified good slap across your mouth, and you told an interviewer that you grew up in a violent, religious, blue-collar home, and some of your poems are about the violence, the love and the violence from your mother, from your father, that juxtaposition of those two almost incomprehensible feelings or emotions.
Yeah, I think poems are best when they are honest about what love is. I think of myself as a love poet, and I hope when I'm gone, if anybody has anything to say about me, I hope they remember that thing about me, that I was a love poet, and that always love is always complicated. It's complex. It's not as simple as the Hallmark cards. The reason why we have greeting cards, Hallmark cards, is because we need love simplified on Mother's Day and Father's Day and on your birthday. But the truth about love is that it comes in many shades and it changes over time. And I really want to write poems that are honest about that.
You have written poems. I don't think they're in this book. These are your mother and your grandmother, but you have written poems about your father and about his, frankly, his violence towards you, and just sort of, I guess, trying to sort of figure out, maybe as an older person as you are now, to understand that kind of a childhood and that kind of relationship that you had with your father.
Yeah, I love my dad, but he really did get on my nerves.
That's one way to put it.
When I was growing, he still does. You know, there's really not a day that my dad does not get on my nerves.
But you don't have to live with him, though, right?
I don't have to live with him anymore. But I'll tell you this. You think you feel one day. I'll tell you, this is 100% true. And I know this is a feeling that many of your listeners have had. You think you know how you feel about your parents. And then a pandemic hits. Mm. And I'm telling you, I have never felt since I left Shreveport, since I left home when I was 18 years old, I've never felt like I needed to be, you know, people grow up and they leave or they come back and they have this feeling that they need to be close to their parents. And I never felt that I needed to be close to my parents until COVID-19, at which point I really felt like I needed to be monitoring their every step. Do you know what I
I
mean?
do.
As the responsible person in my family, I kept thinking, are they really doing this right? Are they wearing masks? Have they washed their hands? And I was so concerned and worried for their well-being. And I'll never forget this. I remember when this year came around and the vaccines came around and my parents finally got vaccinated. I remember just sitting. I actually sat on the same sofa I'm sitting on now, and I just cried out of gratitude. I didn't realize that I had been holding my breath. You know, my parents are in their 70s. I had been holding my breath for an entire year. You know what I mean, Martin? And I had no idea that I was so worried about them until after they were vaccinated, and I felt a little bit of that weight come off. My relationship with my dad, yeah, it's really a fraught and complex relationship, and sometimes better long distance. Really good on the phone. He said recently, you know, we talk on the phone more now than we did the whole time you were growing up.
I hear you.
So things are always better in hindsight. And he did the best he could. I grew up in a town that was, when I was growing up, overridden by crack cocaine and gang violence. And I think my dad, I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional, but I think my mom and dad did everything in their power. They saw that I was a young black man who could befall all kinds of ills, and they did everything in their power to make sure I didn't befall those ills.
And you did not. That's Jericho Brown. We're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. He's a poet. He teaches, he's the director, I should say, of the creative writing program at Emory University. And he's his latest collection of poems is called The Tradition. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Jericho Brown is our guest. He is a poet. His latest collection, The Tradition, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2020. He's also this year's One Book, One Philadelphia writer. That's a project of the Free Library of Philadelphia and the City of Philadelphia to encourage literacy and discussion across the region. Again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Jericho Brown, you were named for your father, Nelson Demery. He was junior. You were Nelson Demery III.
Yeah.
Why did you change your name to Jericho Brown, and why Jericho Brown?
Oh, I changed my name because I finally started seeing poems in magazines, and I couldn't be happy about it. I kept thinking I was sharing these poems with my dad and my granddad, and I wanted something that was only mine, you know? So I would look at the poem and I'm like, this name isn't right. It was really difficult too, writing about my dad with my dad's name.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
So I also, it was a very scary time for me in my life. I was embarking. I had this job that was a real job. I was a speechwriter for the mayor of New Orleans, and I was giving all of that up to go get a PhD and to go be a poet, whatever that meant. It looked like I was going to be broke forever. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So I wanted to do something that would completely give me an identity to work toward. It's not that I was trying to change my identity. It's that I was trying to be a better version of myself. And I actually dreamed the name Jericho in a very strange dream. And so when I woke up, I decided that was it. I was Jericho Brown.
Did it have anything to do with coming out as a gay man?
Yeah, I think that was a lot of it. I think being queer and understanding that I had to become more comfortable with that. I needed to, it's almost like I needed to make myself be who I needed to be. I needed to push myself toward a certain kind of self-acceptance. Self-acceptance is something that we sort of realize we need to have intellectually, but it's hard to have in life every day. And so you sort of walk around trying to gain it. And I thought, You know who would have it is somebody named Jericho. So every day, you know, every day I'm still doing this. I'm trying to be everything I think of Jericho. That's what I want to be. I want to be like that guy that I envisioned when I was a kid, when I was thinking about changing my name.
Was it, I mean, you grew up, as you describe, it sounds like a very religious household, Shreveport, Louisiana, coming out as a gay, I don't know, teenager, a young man. How difficult was that for you?
Well, I definitely wasn't a gay teenager. I mean, okay. You know, I wasn't in a situation where you could be a gay teenager at that time. And I think that's hard for people to understand. But, you know, it was a very different time, Marty. I don't think I really started seeing men in any kind of a public way until I was 25 years old, 24.
Wow.
It was quite hard for me. That's another reason why this book, The Tradition, exists. Part of what I want to highlight is intersectionality. I want to highlight the fact, as I said before in this show, that there are no single issues. All the issues are complex and all the issues are intertwined. And me being queer, me being black, me having these experiences with the police, me having this experience with my mom and dad, me growing up the way I grew up with the casinos and with the religion, all of that is a piece of what makes me the whole human being I am now.
You contracted HIV from, I'll let you say it because, you know, words matter so much. And I do want to have you read a poem, Duplex. You have a series of them called Duplex, and there's a reason for that. But just help us understand this on page 27, putting this poem in context.
Yeah, it's a poem about a rape. I was raped when I was younger, when I first moved to Houston, Texas. Where I got my PhD, and while I was there, it was something that I think I was completely silent about for forever. It wasn't a thing that I could talk to anybody about. And this book actually gave me one of the first opportunities where I could talk about it in multiple poems. So I'll read Duplex. The Duplex is a form that I invented, and it's a sonnet, but it's also a huzzle, and it's also a blues poem. And I think you'll hear those elements of that form come out. Duplex. The opposite of rape is understanding, a field of flowers called paintbrushes. A field of flowers called paintbrushes, though the spring be less than actual. Though the spring be less than actual, men roam shirtless as if none ever hurt me. Men roam that myth in truth. One hurt me. I want to obliterate the flowered field, to obliterate my need for the field and raise a building above the grasses, a building of prayer against the grasses. My body a temple in disrepair. My body is a temple in disrepair. The opposite of rape is understanding.
And again, that's Jericho Brown reading from his latest collection of poems, The Tradition. Help us understand what you're saying there.
One of the things I think that I'm saying here, and again, here's nature, you know, that field of flowers called paintbrushes. There's a place in the mind I think I created for myself where I just couldn't accept who I was. And so I created a place in my head, in this poem at least, a place in my head that was all beauty. Right, as if nothing awful had happened to me. And I think one of the things that I realized by the end of the poem is that in order to live more fully, we have to accept even the horrible and traumatic things that have happened to us, that they make us who we end up being. And you can't push them aside in a way as if they never existed. And I think being honest about them puts you in a position where you can help other people get through them.
So, right. I mean, it's almost a cliche to say this. So for writing for you is a way to understand yourself, what happened to you in this instance.
Yeah. I needed my poems. I've been writing about this in really maybe not as straightforward ways since my first book came out in 2008. And it wasn't until this book that it became much more direct. And it wasn't until this book that I really feel like I healed from it or of it. that I allowed it into my life in a way that I could address it directly. Even being on the radio now, when you said it, I was so surprised. I was like, how does she know that? But you know it because I told you, because
right.
I tell people, because I can talk about it now, you know, almost 20 years later, in a way that I couldn't talk about it before.
Can I ask you, I didn't put this on my list of things for you to read, but on page 70, there's Cakewalk, which I feel is a bit of a you know, maybe the opposite side of that poem that you just read.
Yeah, I'd love to read this poem because it's a really good example of what I was saying when I was talking about that complex love poem, right? Here's a poem called Cakewalk. My man swears his HIV is better than mine, that his has in it a little gold, something he can spend if he ever gets old. Claims mine is full of lead, slows you down, he tells me, looking over his shoulder. But I keep my eyes on his behind. Say my HIV is just fine, practical, like pennies, like copper. It can conduct electricity, keep the heat on, or shock you. It works hard, earns as much as my smile.
I like that poem. I mean, this is your, these are your superpowers, right?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm just glad that I got away with saying that I was looking at a man's butt in a poem, but I keep my eyes on his behind.
Yeah, we heard that. Well, it's interesting to, I'm not interesting, that's probably not the right word, but you know, here we're talking about HIV and living, you know, with COVID, this other virus that has taken mm-hmm. more than 500,000 people from us just in this country alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This isn't the first virus that the United States government ignored, though it is the first that it seems that the United States government clamored to find a cure for. There was another one that no one was looking for a cure for a very long time. And so it's an interesting moment for me to see how this is being handled differently and how it's being handled in the exact same ways. It always seems that the dollar is king, you know what I mean? I remember when this all first began, I remember thinking, wow, they're finding a way to go back to work, and they just found out today. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the show must always go on for the dollar, it seems. Yeah.
In thinking about, that virus and having HIV, I have to ask, how is your health? How are you living with it?
I'm very well. Actually, I have a poem about it. I think you had mentioned me reading this poem. So
yes.
I'll read this.
Yeah.
I'll read this poem now. And part of the reason why I think the book gained a lot of popularity is because of this poem, because it seems not just a poem about me or about that time of my life or maybe even about HIV, but outside of that context, it seems like it, in many ways, is a poem about the times we're living in now and about the pandemic, the virus. And I should mention this poem is in the voice of the virus.
Right.
The virus. Dubbed undetectable, I can't kill the people you touch. And I can't blur your view of the pansies you've planted outside the window. Meaning, I can't kill the pansies, but I want to. I want them dying, and I want to do the killing. I want you to heed that I'm still here. Just beneath your skin and in each organ, the way anger dwells in a man who studies the history of his nation. If I can't leave you dead, I'll have you vexed. Look, look again. Show me the color of your flowers now.
So that's the virus that lives inside you?
Yeah, and you know, the virus that lives inside me would have me believe that things are over, that all is not well. And so I think the virus that lives inside me actually created an opportunity for gratitude for me, because I know better than that. You know, I'm a person who can look at those flowers and still see the beauty of those flowers. I think we have things that happen to us and people tell us, well, that's it. That means you're doomed. It's over for you. But in truth, it doesn't have to be over for you. There are still flowers. They are the same color as they were before. And you can't let the virus win, no matter what that virus is in your life, you know.
I want to have you read, I picked out so many poems for you to read, but I want to have you read one more. This is called Dark.
Oh, yeah. Can I read this poem on air? Are you sure?
I think so. I double checked it. I think we're okay.
Good. Okay, good.
I don't think there are any bad words in here. I don't think so.
Let's see.
Page 67.
67. Here it is. Here's a poem called Dark. Dark. I am sick of your sadness, Jericho Brown, your blackness, your books, sick of you laying me down so I forget how sick I am. I'm sick of your good looks, your debates, your concern, your determination to keep your butt plump, the little money you earn. I'm sick of you saying no when yes is as easy as a young man. Bored with you saying yes to every request, though you're as tired as anyone else, yet consumed with a single diagnosis of health. I'm sick of your hurting. I see that you're blue. You may be ugly, but that ain't new. Everyone you know is just as cracked. Everyone you love is as dark, or at least as black.
So what's behind that poem, Dark?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of a poem that's trying to do the same thing I was doing when I was talking. You want to talk, it's a poem that talks to the self, right?
Right.
I literally say in the poem, I'm sick of your sadness, Jericho Brown.
Exactly.
You know, sometimes I think my sadness is real cute, and I think it's real pious. Do you know what I mean? I think I'm the good guy. And sometimes I get sick of myself. It says, I'm sick of your sadness. I'm sick of your books. I'm sick of your determination to work out all the time, you know. So it's a poem that by the end of the poem, it uses its humor to encourage, I hope. Yeah.
Well, it's always interesting who that voice is in our head that's always telling us things like that, right?
Yeah. What I really love about this poem is how the poem says that everybody's just as dark as I am. You know, I'm not so special in that regard, so I can get off it. You know what I'm saying? So I love it. I love it.
Here's another email, this one from Paul. He says, I sometimes am depressed when things are still the same in this country, but when I discovered Jericho's poems as a public art installation at Art Yard in Frenchtown, New Jersey, I read bullet points aloud and I cried.
Wow. Thank you so much. Tell me his name again.
His name is Paul.
Thank you, Paul. That's wonderful. Thank you.
I read, and we're almost out of time here, that you said Luther Vandross is your greatest influence. True?
I don't know if he's my greatest influence, but he's up there. He's really my greatest influence right now. I listen to him every day. He's sort of an inspiration to me because he was so exact about his singing, about the arrangements, about the way the background dancers were going to sound and look. And I'm really interested in him as an artist, but I'm also interested in him as a closeted gay man who made a lot of straight people have babies. You know, Luther Vandross's music is known as the music of romance, as the music of the erotic. He said so himself, you know, he wanted to sing the love songs and he was very clear. They're not sex songs, they're love songs. And I identify with that, as I've said in many ways. He's one of my favorite people.
Well, Jericho Brown, it's been such a pleasure. I thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And again, his latest collection of poems won the Pulitzer Prize in 2020. It's called A Tradition, and he is the One Book, One Philadelphia author this year. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Kelsey Hansen. And today we welcome Paige Murray Bessler, our new Radio Times producer. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.